मज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नामश्रेष्ठां मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रम् अत्र स्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरुपुरीं मथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरं महोराधिकमधावशं प्रप्तु यस्या प्रतीत्यग्रीपाया श्रीगुरुं तं नतस्मि। वन्दे श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यनित्यानन्दसहादितो गोददाय पुष्पवन्तचित्रसंज्ञोत्तमोऽनुतो जयतं श्रतो भङ्गुर्माममन्दमतिर्गति मत्सर्वस्वपदाम्बुजराधमदनमोहनम् दिव्यबृन्दरण्यकल्पद्रुमदा श्रीमद्रत्नगारसिंहासनस्थं श्रीमन्राधश्रीलघुविन्ददेवपृष्ठालिविश्व्यामनुस्मरामि श्रीमं रासरासरं विभांसिवतथास्थितः कर्षं वेनुशनैर्गोपीर्गोपीनाथ श्रियस्तु नः। भक्त्यविहीनायापराधलक्षये क्षिप्तश्चाकमादित्यरङ्गमाध्ये कृपमयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं। श्री सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। श्री एकादशी की जय। गौर प्रेमान हरी हरी बोल। इट्स अ ब्लेसिंग टू बी विद ईच वन ऑफ यू अगेन टुडे। वेलकम वेलकम एंड इट्स एन ऑनर टू होस्ट यू समहाउ ट्राइंग टू होस्ट आवर दैट्स आवर our life project, right? To become better hosts of grace. No? So each one of you is grace personified, coming to knock on our door to bless our lives. And we are invited to expand our hosting capacity, basically, right? That's the whole project, to make the heart bigger, to make the hosting of grace more comprehensive. That's how gradually the Atma becomes a Mahatma, as Krishna will say in the Bhagavad Gita. Mahatmanastu mam partham daivim prakritimashrita. According to the degree that you take shelter in the divine nature, from Atma you turn to Mahatma. The self becomes a big self and a bigger self and a bigger self. It's not that necessarily the body keeps expanding, but our hosting capacity keeps expanding, right? Like our potential to tend to the necessities of love continue to bloom, and there is no end to that journey. So this is just quote unquote a momentous gathering among so many other momentous gathering we are having every week, in which hopefully we are arriving with that hope, right? With that longing to continue crafting the vessel of our heart, the Kripa Patra, the recipient of grace, so we can learn the art of hosting, holding space, bringing more spaciousness into the heart space to properly honor, receive, serve grace. And again, grace comes in so many forms, each one of you being today a personification of that. So hopefully we can properly reciprocate to the gift of your time, of your presence, of your questions, of your witnessing, of whatever needs to be shared today. So that's it. We not only welcome you, but part of the welcome is inviting you to bring any topics on the table, to mention what's something you would like to talk about, something that is tasteful, necessary, conflicting, relishable, urgent. Whatever, right? As a good host, as we were talking the other day, I was recording in Spanish with Dania podcast. I was saying Okay, if you're a host, I was a host. I'm the host of the podcast, so I'm receiving you. It's a good host. I will ask my guest, do you like to eat something? And not only what do you like to eat something, but what's your favorite meal? So from that sense, I was like, so what would you like to talk about today? What's your favorite meal? And sometimes the meal may not be the favorite, maybe just the most urgent meal we need to bring to the table, right? And actually, that was the whole conversation and topics that the whole podcast ended up being called like urgent issues of the soul or something like that. So you are invited to bring to the table anything. It may be your favorite meal, it may not be your favorite, but the most urgent one, it may be a bitter medicine that we all need to hear. May not be sweet, may not be favorite according to our tongue, but maybe necessary. Well, whatever topic, taboo topics, table is willing enough, clean enough, open enough to hopefully hold space to whatever needs to be brought today. So I'm seeing a few digital hands already raised. So you already know, most of you, I think. If you have any question, anything you'd like to share, you can raise your digital hand in Zoom and we'll eventually get there. So we'll begin with Shyam Kunt Prabhu from Czech Republic. You're in Czech Republic?
Yes, Maharaj, Hare
Okay,
Krishna.
just confirming where you were. Yeah.
Yes,
Okay. Well.
thank you, Hare Krishna, and pranams to everyone. I was thinking this week, after a discussion with friends, about the topic of hierarchy, and I would like to hear from you how does a healthy hierarchy looks like kind of hierarchy that facilitates learning from each other and respect and appreciation for each other. So, if you could please say something about this topic. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Some contemplations on hierarchy. Okay, it's funny because this question comes one day after my mom's has her birthday, and I hope I shared an affectionate post, but also it was somehow hierarchical, right? Because in the good sense of the term, that's part of my answer, right? The word hierarchy is not a bad word, so. Naturally, there is a hierarchy in so many of our relationships. And as long as that facilitates the loving exchange, that's fine, right? That will be a first thing that as much as I'm not a hierarch, I wouldn't consider myself like a hierarchical person in the sense of trying to relate to people from a top-down level with lots of Aishwarya and distancing and reverence. I wouldn't say that that's the only thing to say about hierarchy, right? So you can have elders in your life, whether it is mom, dad, teachers, whomever. And there can be full love there, but there is some sense of hierarchy. Now, this is an elder. Or you can be an elder to someone else. If you, I don't know, if someone has a baby, the relationship between a 2-year-old and the parents, there is some hierarchy there, right? It's not like the father and mother will say to the 2-year-old, okay, you decide what you want to do with your life today. Let's not be hierarchical, right? We want to be just always equal. That doesn't work, no? So I'm saying all this so we don't go to one extreme nor the other, right? Middle path, yukta, as Krishna will say in the Gita, as Rupa Goswami will say, yukta, everything has to be done in a balanced way. So hierarchy for me, it serves a purpose. Again, there can be an admiration that we have for someone that we consider, you referred in your question to a teacher or to an elder, and you can see someone that's more advanced than you or more mature, more wise, more whatever, in a healthy way. Again, not the thing is that all this happens in a way that is healthy for us. No, not that, I mean, there's beautiful place to find someone. Wow, that person is so wise, so beautiful, so advanced, so deep, and I feel fortunate to be close to that person. So I'm not thinking in I'm feeling threatened by proximity to someone better than me, because it's not even a thing that is better than me. We don't need to even talk in those terms. Of course, we can talk in terms of souls that are more awakened than others. In principle, every soul, no soul is better than other, right? In constitution, every Atma is Atma, and their potential of the Atma is equally brilliant for everyone. But some souls have actualized that potential more than others. And I wouldn't say to say that is to be sectarian or racist or whatever, no? Too far right, or because sometimes we may want to force a sense of equality in a way that it's hiding something else, no? Like probably showing my unwillingness to relate to someone that I may learn from. So I want everyone to be on an equal level because I don't want anyone teaching me anything. Sometimes that can happen because I may have some inferiority complex. So I need everyone to be on my level, right? But we have to be all equal always. Again, in principle, we are all equals, souls in connection to the same center. We are, as I like to say, the center is at the center of the table. Today we are sitting all and this around the center, and everyone is at the same distance from the center. Krishna loves everyone unconditionally. No need to make this a competition game, right? Who is more advanced, who is better, who is worse? And of course, if someone is an elder, if someone is a true elder, true wise, true guide, true teacher, whether it is guru, mom, dad, whomever, they will express their elderhood in a way that is dignifying to the younger ones, so to say, or to the ones who are learning from them, not in a way that is humiliating, that is like disempowering, that is putting people down, that is creating fear and intimidation, that is fostering all these types of toxic patterns. So again, there is a place for hierarchy. It's not necessarily bad. It creates some sense of order in certain dynamics. It gives some structure to some things, to relationships. Again, I may relate on an equal level with friends, but also there are different ways of having friendship, for example, right? That's a point. Like Rupa Goswami says, Bishram Bena Guru Seva. Bishram Bena Guru Seva. When he describes his 64 angas of bhakti, this is the number four, Bishram Bena Guru Seva. The disciple is invited to relate to offer seva to the guru in the spirit of Bishramba. So Bishramba means like confidence, and there's a type of trust in the relationship, and there's a type of friendship. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that you relate to your guru as a friend in the same way you may relate to other friends. So there are different types of friendship. And I will say it's necessary, healthy, not necessarily like an imposition, but healthy if you have a teacher, a guide, a mentor, spiritual director, that you have some respect for that person, that you hold that person with some sense of reverence. Again, reverence is not a bad word, right? I don't know if some of you have heard that word for some decades and trigger something else. It's not that I need to be nervous in his or her presence, that we need to be very distant, that I have to be afraid about what may happen at the next moment. It's just more a type of affectionate admiration, not even like idolizing, right? Not just making a guru a rock star, or like being starry-eyed, like, and you're absolutizing every single detail of that person's life. But there is a place for a healthy sense of reverence that comes naturally from your own experience, right? It's never that the elder is imposing, like, you should respect me, you should show reverence for me. Who you think you are? I'm your elder. Well, the more you say that, the more difficult you are making it for me to feel all those things, right? If I come to all of you and I start to impose myself as an elder and tell you all the reasons why you should be respecting me so much, the less you respect me, probably. So it should be very natural, right? A natural elder behaves in a natural way, and his or her elderhood talks for itself. And those who are open, they re relate to that, they feel touched. There's a hierarchy there, but the hierarchy doesn't mean distance, right? Doesn't mean an abyss between those people. Because sometimes we may think of hierarchy only in its toxic expression, but that may be just an overdose of hierarchy, hyper-hierarchical, super-pyramidal structure. That it may be too much. Of course, I agree, that's too much. I speak about that in the chapter Guru and Disciple in Radical Personalism. But that doesn't mean that we do away with all hierarchy altogether, and I just treat anyone and everyone like my peer, my equal, in the very same way, because that's also a form of, how to say, like flat reductionism. Like all relationships should be reduced to this way of relating. So I will treat that doesn't work, right? There are many rasas, right? There is Sakya rasa, there is friendship one-on-one. There are different types of Sakya rasa, by the way. There are vatsalya. I kind of treat my father and my mother as I will treat my friend that I treat him, I relate to him as my equal or my brother and sister. That doesn't mean that I'm loving my mom and dad less, right? There is a unique flavor. Each relationship affords the deepest level of intimacy. You can be very deep and intimate and affectionate in every one of these rasas, if we want to use this word, right? With a friend, with a servant, with the elder, with a lover, with a parent. Each one offers their own unique flavor, of course, of relationship. But in each one of those, we are invited to go deep, deep. But each one has its own way of hierarchy, its own way of where each one stands in the relationship. But that standing is for the sake of the relationship, for the sake of the deepening of the relationship. So I think that's a sweet mix, right? To have proper reverence in going back, because you mostly included the term of teacher and student, which is how many times we interpret the word hierarchy. And Krishna says kind of something like that also, interestingly. Well, Krishna is the original teacher. Like, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the chapter Shloki, chapter 10, verse 8, Krishna's first two lines speak about Aishwarya, and the second two lines speak about Madhurya. And by Madhurya, I mean sweetness and intimacy, not necessarily romantic love. By Aishwarya, I mean an appreciation of God's majesty, which doesn't necessarily to be scary. It can evoke beautiful sense of awe and then wonder, like a passive admiration of, wow, God is everywhere. Wow, wonder. I'm invited to participate in this reality. And then the more we participate, the more intimate it becomes, and you at one point lose sight God's godhood. That's at least our philosophy. So Krishna says that in the Gita. Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate. First two lines. I'm the source of everything. Everything emanates from me. That's pretty Aishwaric, right? That's pretty majestic. Imagine if I meet you and I introduce yourself to you. Who are you? I'm the source of everything. It's like, okay. You may take like, oh, okay. Okay. Wow, it has its own charm. Wow, the source of everything. Everything is emanating from you. And then he says, Iti matva bhajante mam Buddha bhava samambita. And those who know me as such, they worship, adore me with all their faculties very lovingly. So that brings the idea of intimacy. But in our tradition, you cannot have Madhurya without Aishwarya. Aishwarya. Madhurya includes Aishwarya plus something more. In other words, Krishna is charming as a baby, especially charming as a baby because he's God. If he will be a baby like any other baby, he will be charming like any baby is. No? There we have Nimai over there. Just a practical example. Jai Nimai. So you have a charming one. Now imagine Okay, there's Nimai. So imagine if your baby happens to be the source of everything. And on top of that, he's a baby. So that creates a unique combination of charm, right? So that my point with all this is that there is reverence, there is acknowledgement or some respect, but that can facilitate intimacy in a very unique mixture of experiences. I'm talking about God, but it can be applied to any other relationship. So some notion of hierarchy can be there, or someone being seen as a superior, as an elder, again, in a healthy way, not in a way that is self-diminishing, toxic, shame, guilt inducing. We are not going there, hopefully, but in a way that is dignifying. So I can revere someone, adore someone, but in a way that I don't feel that's getting in the way of my affection to that person. And that can grow deeper and deeper and deeper. So that's what Rupa Goswami means with Vishram Bena Guru Seva. Serve your guru with trust, as a type, as with a form, it's a form of friendship, but it's a unique form of friendship that also includes not only Vishramba or distrust, but also Gaurav, which is type of reverence by appreciating and being grateful and admiring the who that person may be. That's not bad. Again, as long as it doesn't come from a place of idolatry, spiritual bypassing, escapism, over-idealizing, and all these type of things, which may be the case in many cases, and we need to work on that also. As in this case, students, if we're approaching someone, how much can I make sure that I'm approaching a teacher for the right reasons, and how much I'm willing to be educated by that teacher about many wrong reasons that I'm still carrying into the relationship with that teacher, right? That should be a natural part of that type of interaction. And of course, the teacher has to do his or her own shadow work as well. And the relationship with the student may bring forth some of that as well. So it's a, each one from their own place, it's a mutual learning from each other. But yeah, basically, I will say that, right? There's no need to annihilate hierarchy in all of its forms, because I no need to go to like a sheer anarchy, and no need for any of that. But also, yeah, let's not become overtly hierarchical when the relationship becomes like cold and distant and dysfunctional based on fear and intimidation, whether it is with a guru, whether it is with anyone. I mean, ideally, we should not be relating to anyone with fear and intimidation being the main udipan, the main like stimulus for the relationship. That's toxic by nature. So sometimes that's imposed from the other side of the relationship. Sometimes we are bringing our own baggage in that regard. Sometimes it's a little bit in both sides. So we need to figure out how to deal with that in ways that gradually, because we may not be able to cancel all that immediately, but gradually have the healthiest possible pattern in all our in each of our relationships, right? And again, without throwing the baby away with the bathwater, no need to cancel all forms of hierarchy altogether. As long as the fruit of love and intimacy and trust is continues to grow, actually hierarchy can facilitate that. Like an institution can facilitate the delivery of a particular content. A glass can facilitate, as a vessel, the delivery of certain substance. So certain hierarchies are there to give shape to a certain experience, to facilitate a particular experience of loving interaction. That's what comes. No, it's not hierarchy for hierarchy's sake, right? Hierarchy is not in itself the goal. It's just a facilitator. So it's in the service of something, right? It's like a canvas. The canvas is not the goal in itself. The canvas is there to facilitate my artistic expression onto the canvas. And it has to be, without the canvas, I cannot give shape to my inner inspiration. So it's, in one sense, it's very important. But in one sense, it's very secondary at the same time. So similarly, some hierarchical structures in relationships are there to give shape or allow the expression of certain inner content. But we should be careful not to over-absolutize them to the point that they replace the content, they replace the experience, and they become the thing unto itself. Because when that happens, we have a totalitarian regime or something close to that in our relationships. I don't know if that helps, Shamkund, if there are any further reflections in that regard.
Yes, thank you very much. It especially this last thought of hierarchy being the vessel or deliverer of healthy relationships is very much helpful. Thank you, Maharaj.
Well, thank you. And I'm checking messages. I'm seeing that Badr is commenting. Sometimes, out of social etiquette, for the sake of peace in family or society, it is necessary, or it may feel that it is necessary, to show respect to someone who is older, an elder, even though they may not be a more expanded soul. Yeah, I get the point. I wouldn't make a full comparison, like synonymous between parallel between older and elder, right? We all grow older. But we not all grow elder. So that you have 70, 80, 90 years old doesn't mean that you are an elder. And you can be 16 years old and you can be an elder. And that's the point that the Bhagavatam makes, right? Sukadev Goswami enters into the assembly, 16-year-old naked boy. Everyone stands up, recognizing here comes the elder. And they give him the seat of honor. And they all accept him as the elder of the assembly. That's very counterintuitive to how we think. But it's all an invitation to become Saragrahi, right? To look at the essence and not just the external form. Because sometimes we are drawn to external forms. If someone has like white hair, long beard, is old in age, we tend to equate that, okay, that equates wisdom. Not necessarily, not necessarily. But yeah, as you say, sometimes there may be a place for some what we call etiquette or decorum, which will be more of a formal respect, so to say. But for me, that's not the same with substantial love and adoration and for a person. Sometimes, yeah, one may show some formal respect to someone, but that doesn't mean that that person became my elder or whatever, right? That has to be chosen by me, and the person has to show that that person deserves my trust, so to say, not because I am so special. It's just it has to be a voluntary dynamic, and we should also, I will say, be careful in the context of showing formal respect at some circumstances, and I'm talking in general here. We have to be careful not to end up becoming too diplomatic and too formal, right? Because at the end, everything can end up being a formality, and we may end up like showing respect to everyone as an excuse not to having to confront anyone with things that sometimes we need to confront. Confront is not a bad word. Confront means to put in front of me what needs to be seen, what needs to be spoken about. So you may be my older or even my elder, and at some point I may need to confront you. Not because I think I'm better than you, not because I'm a rebel without a cause, not because you are an operati. But because there are some pressing issues that may need to be spoken as part of our relationship. It's part of any relationship, and sometimes it happens. And that's not disrespecting the person. Actually, that's the opposite. I'm showing the person how much I love the person, and that's why I dare to bring this topic into the relationship, because I care for the relationship. And that's why, as I mentioned, the conclusion of radical personalism, confrontation can be seen as a form of intimacy. If done properly, again, I'm not just saying confrontation, let's confront everyone. I love you. But confrontation coming from a genuine place is fostering intimacy, is fostering the deepening of a relationship. And of course, there is a price to that, because when you do that, not everyone will like that. And some people will basically leave the relationship. I have some experience of that. And I try to confronting intimacy as a loving sign, people that I consider my elder, and they were not able to take it. They were not willing to listen to that. They were not able to engage in that openness to a conversation. And sometimes the relationship was basically lost in one sense. So that happens in life. You lose relationships. But I think there's, how to say, it's not easy. Nobody wants that. But also we should, I personally couldn't just remain on a diplomatic platform with everyone so I don't lose the relationship. Well, I deeply know we need to talk about some things. There are things that need to be solved. No, let's keep it like formal so there's no loss of the relationship. But there's no relationship to begin with. If I'm not being honest with you, what relationship do we have? Maybe a very formal, superficial, external one. Well, if we want to call that a relationship, fine. But if you want to have deep, loving connection with people, there will be moments that you need to talk stuff, and that will may call it confrontation in intimacy. And some people will accept that, and the relationship will grow. I also have beautiful experiences of that, and that's how you take a relationship to the next level and to the next level. And sometimes you lose the relationship. There is a risk involved in trying to go deeper because not everyone wants to go deeper. Not everyone wants to see some things. And no, I'm not condemning that people. Sometimes it's us, the ones who do not want to see something. Sometimes it's the other. Sometimes we are both. Just acknowledging those things. And yeah. All that to say, yeah, sometimes we may need to be bureaucratic, protocolar, formal, diplomatic, but be careful, let's not make a universal standard. All our relationships end up being that. And knowing also in the name of confrontation, not being like a brutal truth-telling machine that I'm confronting everyone in a way that is too much, and I'm not being actually sensitive. So yeah, developing a discernment of Desha Kalapatra, right? Time, place, circumstance, what's the best? And if I miss the mark, I can always shoot again. Okay, we can go for a few minutes to our breakthrough rooms. Praying for a further breakthrough. It can always come if you want a new one. So Bhaktarasa will invite us there. And feel free to share your experiences, your thoughts, whatever has been churning your heart and mind after this brief discussion. And see you back in a few minutes. Welcome back. Hoping you had a nourishing time together. I know it's always too short. That's part of the deal, to leave some thirst and hunger or more for the next breakthrough room. So we're invited now to the next raised hand. In this case, it's Nanda Kumar from Latvia, I assume. He's here. He's there.
Yes, my respects, all of you beautiful people. I'm straight from sauna. I'm living in sauna
Okay.
now. This is real. Okay, so I have a like a theme, which is, I mean, it's been going on for a while, but it's connection with the self and trying to be aware, less in the head, but more in the body. What's happening with different people, for example. Here was a nice topic of confrontation. How do I feel with different people? And but there is another theme which came up just recently, is a desire. And apparently, desire is not bad. It gives direction when the desire is clear and like that. I have not understood the concept, and I realized I have stepped over myself so many times in the name of being in a role or being a good devotee or whatever, that connection to myself and that inner compass or that desire has been suppressed so many times that it's hard to find it now. do what, and you know, and we, and then there is also a balance, right? We can't just follow all the desires. I mean, what's the these amplitudes? It's basically journey to rediscover my own drive, my inner compass. What do I really want? And that's not bad. That's actually good. But then, you know, putting a few safety stops and putting Krishna's desire also in the picture. So, I know this is a big topic, Krishna's desire, our desire. But anyway, I would like to hear what are your reflections on this one?
You're not making it any easy to me, huh? You're bringing your life theme and just any reflections you have. So, do you want me to tell you what do you want in your life? Do you want me to reinforce codependency? Okay, I see, Nanda Kumar. You're coming from
No,
that place.
I'm done. I'm done with that one.
No,
That one, no.
it's okay. We are
No,
just
I.
beginning. We are just beginning with what you don't want. Let's begin.
Yes.
Via
Actually,
negativa,
that's.
neti.
Yes.
Sometimes
Yes.
that's
No,
the
I have to.
clear, no? When we don't have very clear what do I want, one of the clearest way to begin is what I do not want. Because we may have more clarity in that direction, right? And sometimes we need to stay some time there. What do we do not want? Not to end the whole conversation in negatives, but sometimes we need to dismantle, deconstruct. But we have to be careful that in that dismantle and deconstruction, there is no reconstruction. Right? Because at the end of the day, life is not only about deconstruction. Because deconstruction. But we are deconstructing to reconstruct. If not, just deconstruction for its own sake is dangerous. Right, like Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he will give this famous lecture called "From Anartha Nivritti to Artha Pravritti." Right, probably you are more familiar with the term Anartha Nivritti than with the term Artha Pravritti, right? So Anartha Nivritti means, in one sense, you could translate Nivritti as deconstructing, like deconstructing false values or getting rid of false values, false beliefs. So Anartha Nivritti, I like to describe, as I remember we talked in Austria last year, the whole retreat was around that. What's Anartha Nivritti really? And one part of the truth of Anartha Nivritti is that Anartha Nivritti is not the end of the story. It's not just about deconstructing false beliefs. Though sometimes it may feel like I need to stay here for a long time. I need some intensive chapter of deconstruction of deprogramming, if you even want to use that word. But all that is for the sake of reconstruction. So Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say, from Anartha Nivritti, we have to go to Artha Pravritti. From getting rid of false values, we have to move to attaining the real value. At the end of the day, the whole thing is a positive journey. It doesn't end up with what not to do, what to get rid of, what I do not want. We may need to stay there sometime, as it may be your case or my case or the case of many. But we should remember, this is not just a nihilistic journey that ends up in zero or in negative numbers. So that to begin with. I
I
mean, I
could
must.
interject.
Yes, please.
In practicing for many years, you know, there is the idea, you know, what I should want. But the question is, how to go down?
Take out the word should.
Okay, how I. How I align or authentic that I want. You know, there's a difference. Oh yeah, I want. No, there is a difference when you know it goes. There's a difference in voice, there's a difference in
Yeah.
everything. So I'm talking about that one.
And by the fact of your clarification, it seems to me that you have a clear that there is a difference in those.
I hope.
I mean, there are degrees of being aware of that, but to some degree, you know that's the case. So I will just invite you to pay attention to that you already know. To those things that you're already experiencing, and to have a clear experiential vision of what's the thing that I really want. Not the, because of course we don't want here to just promote, oh, whatever you want, just go after that. That's what you need. That's the most important thing. Sometimes we want stupid things. We want things that are escapism. We want things that are completely harmful for others or for ourselves, and we are not saying go for it. So there should be some discernment. If not, we will become like hedonistic beasts, right? In the name of I want. Whatever you want, pursue it. No. First we have to have some basic civilized education on which are healthy desires. Again, as you say, we have nothing against desires, but there are healthy and unhealthy ways to approach them. And we can turn everything into an addiction. And we can just deal with all those same things in a balanced way. So I can eat chocolate in a balanced way, and I can make an addiction out of it. I can use my technology in a balanced way, and I can make an addiction out of it. I can contact my emotions in a balanced way, or I can make an addiction out of them. So, with everything, you know? So that's what I will say is ideally, spiritual practice includes this balancing of our human psychological dimension. So, it's all about becoming more and more aligned with what we call sattva, you know? And sattva means basically clarity. Like we align with ourselves with some level of coherence in life through certain habits and certain ways of living life. And that gives clarity. And in that clarity, we can discern what's temporary, what's coming. And even we allow us to see it, to feel it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are carried away by that. And we do not over-absolutize some of those things. And we know what's of true ultimate value, always in all times and circumstances, and what may hold some temporary value. So, and again, I will say that, as I remember, we talked about that with Christian Chandra Prabhu last year. I will try basically to encourage you and each one of you and each one of us to trust that we have the discernment to know which is which. Because most of us have it. I mean, all of us have it, not all of them may be in the same level of clarity, but many times we underestimate our capacity to connect with what's essential and with what's not. And many times we end up just depending too much on people telling us what to do, what to feel, how to do, how should. Not that I'm not open to receive input and feedback and guidance. That's welcome. We are doing that now. But there is a place in which you are sent back to your own hermit, so to say, hermitage, and discern that for yourselves internally. No? Like you have, let's say, God-given capacities to figure that out. And we have, and it may take time, and it may be confusing. It's not like I sit and in 5 minutes I have figured that out the totality of my existence. Imagine if that will be the case. So it may take time. It may imply confrontation. It may imply messiness. It may imply entering into an unknown space, especially if we are not accustomed to live a life of introspection, a life of self-observation, it feels weird. It feels strange. It feels like a foreign country. They are talking another language here. I don't know what to say, what to do. So we need to gain for more and more immersive experience into that realm. Like if someone is accustomed to sit and meditate for hours or be in silence or pray, they're fine. But if nobody, someone never did that, and you say, okay, do it, it will feel a little awkward. But we all have that. That's come inbuilt in our constitution, right? So we shouldn't underestimate our capacities to discern. And there is a point that we should not allow anyone to know about our lives more than we can know about our lives. I'm not saying that in a place of denial or rebelliousness. We are open to input and feedback and guidance, but certain part of the work, it's between us and us. And as you say, Nanda Kumar, many times that begins with the guts, begins with our body. Depending, we are different people, and each one of us have different personality types if we want to go there. But some of us may be very much in need of paying attention to their gut, so to say. And trust the input that is coming from that place, rather than that getting too stuck from up, from the neck up, when we think and overthink and overthink, and just becomes a spiral that is a trap unto itself, right? And you think too much about yourself, and you try to rationalize about every single thing you are going through. It's like there is no end to that. Vedanta Sutta say Tarka Pratishtha Anat. Through that type of exercise, you have apratishtha. Pratishtha means position, apratishtha means no position. You end up in a limbo. You end up nowhere whatsoever if you just try to figure out reality from the neck up. There is a use to what's going on from the neck up, but not to figure out the totality of reality. That's a dangerous project. So sometimes we need to do the descent work, right? Rather than ascend and transcend, descend and connect more with body and gut and learn from that. There is so much input coming in so many layers and dimensions. And trust that we are equipped to with the tools necessary to discern. Again, we may need input, support, feedback, mirroring back, but there is a moment that we need to also do our work and sit with ourselves and enter the jungle and discern in the jungle and clear, okay, what's really at the depths of things and what's at the surface of things, and what do I choose at the end of the day? This is very simple, but it can be very challenging. For some of us, the fact that you have a choice in how you want to live your life sounds simple, right? It may sound even beautiful, but then you get to the truth that you are responsible for the choices you make that will affect your life journey. Not for worse, hopefully, but there is something up to there's it's up to you on some degree. Not only it's not everything depends on you, but there is a part that depends on how I choose to move. And of course, if we choose to move in a direction that was not the most enlightened one, we always have a second shot and a third and a fourth till we hit the mark. So also no need to get neurotic about it. Because some of us also are that type of people that, okay, I will only take a step if I make sure in a preliminary way that I'm perfectly informed to make the best possible choice before doing it. And you become, as they say, then you bring paralysis by analysis, right? Paralysis by analysis. You think too much, you analyze everything, how all the possible outcomes may come, and try to do the best possible thing, inform yourself as much as you. And your whole life has passed by that point. Instead of just do it. And if it didn't work, try it again and try it again, and it's okay. And pay attention to what's coming, to the signs that are coming, to the experiences that are coming, to the input from outside, from inside. If not, we become frozen. Too much calculation, too much suspicion. Srila Samarasa says suspicion leads to suspension. Another way of saying paralysis by analysis. Right? So, and I'm saying that because I have that tendency myself, right? I'm not talking about Nanda Kumar here. This is like autobiographical. So there is a point that, sometimes there may be difficult to figure out what I'm feeling. And on top of that, one half may have some perfectionist tendencies. So you have already some standard of how to deal with all that stuff. And that in itself is a problem. And that in itself gets in the way of what we need to figure out and experience right now. I'm throwing stuff at you, Nanda Kumar,
No,
and at
no,
everyone, each one of you, but
it's great. It's great.
yeah,
I mean,
take it personal. It's radically personal, but it's
I,
radically personal for all of us, including myself.
yeah. What caught me, I listened to the podcast with Sukavaha, and she was mentioning how she was serving so many years, and at one point she had to live by herself, as to say, take care of herself, and she just didn't know how to do, because for so many years we are you I mean I definitely used to, okay, just tell me what to do, I'll do it. It's like easy to not take the responsibility. And anyway, there was more things, but thank you for throwing stuff at me.
No, it's fine. And it's part of life. Again, there is a part of life that we need to be told what to do. So not to, maybe we stay there a little longer than we thought we will stay. Whatever the case, for some reason we stay there that long. But yeah, there is a point when you need to not depend again on people telling you what to do. Like a real guru, as we will always say, will not tell you what to think, but how to think. So then you know, like Jesus will say in the Bible, and here comes a non-vegetarian example just in case. But if someone is hungry, do not give him a fish, but teach him how to fish, and then you will feed him forever. Like, get the point, right? So in the same way, okay, we may be in that situation, some of us now, and there are degrees of that, right? You gave the example of Sukavaha, but now I, of course, I'm friends with her, and I could say, okay, she did from that moment of initial bewilderment of not having a clue how to proceed. Well, she did pretty well. She's in a fine place now, but it was a journey. So I think, I mean, and those who do the journey are those who can look back and say, at the beginning, I had no clue. So, because again, we may tend to just see one part of the journey and say, oh, this beautiful elder and functional and inspiring. And she will be the first one to say, I was pretty dysfunctional. I was totally fanatical and narrow-minded and did this, did that. But between that and now, there was a journey. And the journey goes on, of course, never ends. But and we are all invited to do the journey, and nobody can do the journey for us. We can have companions on the journey. We can be on the same boat together, of course. That's beautiful. As we talked the other day, individual and collective both have their place. Sangha is beautiful and crucial, but we have to do our place also in the journey. So, responsibility. Beautiful word to be able, response, ability. Right, as I like to make the play of words, the ability to respond. So we are in a situation where we are invited to respond in a certain way, and we feel, I don't know what to do. Okay, begin there. There you are invited to develop an ability to respond. That's an ability, something you cultivate. You develop an ability, like someone develops an ability to play basketball, but they began being a mess doing that, and eventually they develop an ability. So there's a culture, right? There is a training, there is a practice, there is an attempt and a failure and this and that, right? So there's nothing wrong with you, Nanda Kumar. And there's nothing wrong with any of you going through similar dynamics because actually that has to happen. Again, speak about confrontation. Those are moments where you are put with a mirror in front of you and ask, what do you want to do with your life? Right? That's what Krishna tells Arjuna at the end of the Gita. Okay, I've told you all this Bhagavad Gita stuff. Now, what do you want to do? Think about it and do act accordingly. That's how the guru spoke to the student. I presented all this, but do your thing. Think for yourself, decide, and take responsibility. The Gita started with Arjuna wanted to run away from the battlefield, right? Spiritual bypassing. Oh, I want to be a beggar and I want to be contemplative. No. You're escaping. Right? So Krishna said, you don't go in. Take responsibility, basically. The whole Bhagavad Gita could be read through the lens of responsibility, right? Arjuna representing us want to run away. I don't want to confront this stuff. I don't want to take responsibility. And Krishna say, come on, take responsibility, stay here. And at the end, after all, he said, okay, what do you think? How do you want to proceed? Do as you wish. Take responsibility. So, and it's scary, right? It can sound scary to take responsibilities, to grow, to leave the cocoon, right? To become adults. Again, that's why I say older doesn't mean elder. An elder is someone who has undergone all these circles of fire or the fires of ordeal, and you become like crafted by all that, right? You develop all these undeniable qualities. And that can happen at different ages. Again, it's not about age. It's about the willingness to take responsibility. If that happens at a very young age, you are an elder right there. And you can be 70, 80, 90, 100, 3000 and still be childish, not childlike, childish. So, and there are degrees of all this. And a word, a good yardstick will be responsibility, our willingness to respond to life and to develop a newer ability to respond to life, because there's no final graduation from that. You can, I mean, pay attention to the dynamics of Golok Vrindavan. Every day Krishna plays the flute and the gopis, to give an example, they're invited to respond to that in a certain way. And every new flute call is inviting them to develop a new ability to respond to that call. And so many obstacles will be on the way. So they continue growing in responsibility without end in transcendence. So it's responsibility all the way up to heaven, so to say.
And they
So,
need to stay alive to themselves to be able to respond authentically. They can't be, oh, I should respond. It's not enough.
Yeah, from why you, yeah, we should question why I'm saying should so many times. Why did word should got inserted in my vocabulary every two, three words? What's going on there?
Well, there is a lot in books, in our books, there's a lot shoulds. There is. And I think us thinking that we know what we should now automatically we will do and desire, but I didn't work on my case.
Yeah. Again, we have nothing against the word should nor any word. The important thing is how we process all the things, right? And again, at some stage of the journey, we needed that. We needed the shoulds, we need shall not, rules, this, that, fear even, consequence of not doing that. Okay, that was a chapter of the glorious journey. Now it's suffocating, probably, to some of us, not necessarily to all of us. We should be careful not to impose what we need onto the journey of other people that may need the shoulds still, right? So we should be sensitive that not over absolutize my journey to the point that demanding and everyone else joins me in my journey. Because that's not a healthy journey in that case, right? So, but at the same time, not neglecting the unique necessities of my journey, which in one sense The needs of my journey may resemble the needs of many other people's journey, but will never exactly resemble anyone else's journey. Because everyone's journey is unique and irrepeatable. So don't wait to find someone who exactly matches your journey, because that doesn't exist. And that's the invitation to individuate, to acknowledge I'm a unique individual and my journey is unique as everyone else's. And as much as I can gain feedback and input and nourishment, at the end of the day, it's still my own journey and everyone else's journey, and I need to know and choose to how to navigate it. And again, we continue to have choice, and if we make the quote unquote wrong choice, still we can learn from that wrong choice, and in that case it's not a wrong choice. So it's about, as you say, being Srila Siddharth will paraphrase this verse from chapter 2 of the Gita, sincerity is invincible. So you just try to be sincere. Not try to be perfect. Don't try to make the right choice every time. Krishna says in the Gita, in every action there is some imperfection. So he's immediately making you relax about all this perfectionist stuff, right? Say every action has some imperfection. So not to be as imperfect as you can, just to acknowledge there will be always some imperfection. So I cannot be neurotic about full perfection. I can be, in a healthy way, concerned with being sincere, being authentic. And even if I make the wrong choice or step, my sincerity will make me learn from that and get nourishment from that. And in that way, sincerity is invincible. That's invitation to become a sadhu or a sadhvi, male, female, sadhu, sadhvi. Sadhu means from sat, sat is that which is real. So be a real person. Be honest. That means sadhu. Sadhu doesn't mean you are a pure devotee, Mahabhagavat, Nitya Siddha, absolutely enlightened. Sadhu means you are honest. Api chet sudura charu vajante mama nanyabak sadhuri samantabhyah samyak vyavyasito hisa. Krishna says in arguably the most controversial verse of the Gita, 9:30. Even if you misbehave considerably, if you're honest about it, you're a sadhu, in my opinion. I'm quoting Bhagavad Gita all over, just for you to know this is not our own creation here. Those are the words of the Sweet Absolute right there. So yeah, let's keep honesty, sincerity, authenticity, integrity as our compass. Not perfection, no performance, not all that stuff. Okay, we can continue forever, and we will, by God's grace. So that's our hope. But part of our continuum forever includes breakthrough rooms. So we'll go to one of
Thank you.
those now. I don't know how they will work in Golok, but somehow there will be some breakthrough rooms there without Zoom. In 3D, always better. So let's go there and see you in a few minutes. Hey, there you are. Welcome back. Sorry for kidnapping you back into the main room. I know it was cozy there. It felt good. Hopefully, it's still cozy over here as well. So we'll invite next the next raised hand, which was from Jagannidhi Prabhu. Yes, there he is. I was looking where he was. So invited to unmute yourself and welcome,
Hare
Jagannidhi.
Krishna. I want to bring up the subject of the status or the, how to say, position of Srila Prabhupada, Chilaesi Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I was thinking a lot about that, and I also have gone through a development on my outlook on that. When I was first re actually I first met, not personally of course, but I met Prabhupada in one magazine, in one German magazine, as it is, it was called VS East. And but then I got the second canto
1986, and I was reading this second canto from the beginning till the end in a few days. So I thought this is a very nice person, and he has some mission, and he is presenting this philosophy, and I liked it, and I wanted to dive deeper, as with any other subject which caught my attention. And then I went to the temple. I was reading this book, and I actually was reading almost the whole Bhagavatam before I went to the temple for the first time. And then I also was taught that Prabhupada is Uttamadikari, and whatever that means, and what this implies, and that is a very special person. So I accepted that, of course, and I was thinking that all the devotees in the temple, I was thinking anyway that they're all pure devotees, and there were some Prabhupada disciples coming, giving class. So during the first month I was there, and I thought how far out is this to see this person, and he's directly experiencing God in every second of his life, and he can talk with God and so on. So after some time, of course, I had to look closer about all this, and I became also a little frustrated, of course, because my expectations were too, how
The
to say,
honeymoon was over.
honeymoon was over, exactly. So, but then I remember, and I will talk about it in a different way. Today, Prabhupada's position, of course, is seen by different people in very different ways. And there are devotees who are really, in some way, criticizing Srila Prabhupada for saying some outrageous things or whatever one wants to call them. It depends from the perspective. I myself, I had a very, I actually liked Srila Prabhupada also as a, I didn't know Prabhupada, of course, so much because I couldn't figure out what this person is really about. But as a, what it's called, I have here some word. Yeah, as projection surface. So because I was grown up as I grew up as a Christian, and had always this impression that people who are theistic, they have to hide somewhere. There is the modern world, and it's modern to be atheistic. And if you want to go to church, to sneak in that no one sees that you're attending mass or something like that. And Prabhupada, he really was this bold person. He was the real person, so to say. He's a devotee, and he wants to serve God. And he brought this up for me personally to a totally new level of in regard to self-esteem or spiritual self-esteem. So I always had a comfortable feeling with him. But of course, also I heard all these things, and there are also people saying that Prabhupada, for instance, he was a Bengali gentleman. He attended Scottish Church College, and he was somehow also conditioned by all these influences. And so one can look at his statements also from this perspective, and so on. And actually, when I consider all these different things, then it is a little bewildering, because Prabhupada, in one way, it is said he's Uttama Adhikari. So there is talk about Uttama Adhikaris in Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadev Goswami, Srila Vyasadev, and all these persons are Trikala Gya. And they know, Shukadev Goswami knows very nicely how to explain the structure of the universe. And then Prabhupada says, Krishna has helped me, but still I couldn't really figure it out. And they tried to find out some astronomers in India and astrologers who could help the devotees figuring that out. So, and then Prabhupada said, I can travel on the rays of the sun, so I go by airplane to be just one with you. So I want to make it short, but there are so many seemingly totally contradictive contradictions what in this regard, what devotees are thinking about Prabhupada, how Prabhupada presents himself, and so on. So, what? What is actually an Uttama Adhikari? And so, if Prabhupada is an Uttama Adhikari, so is he Sarvagya? Because it's different to talk here about Srila Vyasadeva or about all these persons in the Bhagavatam, because they are somewhere far out. So they are, for I have a theoretical relationship, so I can accept them as whatever they are. Well, but Srila Prabhupada, it becomes much more concrete. Or is this the right word?
Let's say something about it, because there are like 108 topics in that
Yes.
question
Okay.
only.
Okay.
And I know
Okay,
Jagannathi
sorry.
Prabhu, and I know his questions always are rich, and I love that. Thank you.
Thank you.
We need a retreat in Austria to address this question only.
Yes, of yes,
So
very
that
nice.
was his reason, actually. He made the question, so I had to organize a retreat in Austria. And you all have to come. So see you in
Hare
Austria
Krishna.
soon.
Jai.
I'll give a short answer here, and see you in Austria soon for our retreat in
I
addressing this
liked it. It
topic.
was really worth to
No, and I
raise my
appreciate
hand.
your question, because also the multi-layered, like the multi-layer nature of it shows how actually one topic is tied to another topic, and another topic to another
Yes,
topic. We cannot, you
exactly.
cannot
True.
just isolate this and that's it, because that goes to that and this goes to this. So
Yes.
I'll share some thoughts as much as I can share in the limited time we have today. Of course, we can continue to talk about it. But as you said yourself, Jagannathi Prabhu, many people will have different views, not only on Srila Prabhupada, on anyone, because any person is, as we say before, its own unique individual. So you will never find two exact same views on anyone, technically speaking. Even those who seem to align with whatever this view of Prabhupada, still in some way they have a different opinion about something regarding Prabhupada. So I think it's important to make that point. Like, every single individual will see any other single individual never in the exact same way than the other person, right? So to normalize that diversity in subjective perception. Because if not, if we want to be reductionistic and say there's only one way of seeing Prabhupada, this is the official explanation, the official version, the legal one, that's not possible. There are so many Prabhupadas, as there are so many Krishnas, right? Not to say Prabhupada is Krishna, but there are some point here, like when Krishna enters into the arena in Mathura, right, to fight, and there's this famous verse in the Bhagavatam, Malanamasanirninam. Anyhow, long verse, but that's the verse where Krishna enters, and different people see Krishna differently, right? Like a beloved, like death personified, like the universal form, like an enemy, like a friend. It's the same person, but each one is having their own subjective relationship to that person, experience. So it's the same with Prabhupada, right? So I think it's important, though I will say a few more things, but it's important to pound this particular post. Like, there is no one unique version of Prabhupada, unique only possible way of speaking about Prabhupada or anyone, again, not limited to Prabhupada, any person. That's in one sense, that's a dishonor to the person, to reduce the person to one only single version. We are talking here about a multifaceted jewel, which has so many dimensions and colors and approaches. So that on one side, and speaking about different perspectives, well, you're asking me, so here comes my perspective, which I'm not saying is the only one. Again, after just what I said, it would be absurd to say, now I'll let you know which is the absolute final conclusion on who Prabhupada is. It's nonsense to say that. But I'm okay acknowledging that there is a human dimension to a guru, which is relative, which may include some mistakes, which may include some cultural baggage. I don't have a problem acknowledging that, and at the same time saying that person is a pure devotee. I know that for some people that's not, they won't entertain that. They will see that's contradictory or that's offensive, or that whatever Prabhupada said is always correct. So if he mispronounced a verse, he was testing us. No, it's not that he mispronounced it actually, which is like, that's too much. Like, again, that's tied to why do you need to make that person so perfect in everything? So many times it's not so much about Prabhupada, it's about why we need Prabhupada or whomever to be absolutely impeccable in every single act, because probably our faith is too weak. So we need the other person to be perfect, because at the very small imperfection, my whole faith collapses. Sometimes that happens. It certainly shows like very strong faith. My guru is perfect, he never does anything wrong. But actually, behind that apparently strength, there is weakness. There's the lack of capacity of holding space for mild mistakes. Not to justify great mistakes, of course, I'm not going there. But to accept that my guru maybe may have some imperfection in some relative sense, that he's not compromising his inner world of surrender and divine love. And I'm offered, and that imperfection offers me the chance of rendering service, of developing unconditional love for that person. Because if I only love Prabhupada because he's perfect, that's conditional love. The condition is you are perfect, then I love you. The very moment you stop being perfect in anything, my whole building crumbles because I'm not ready to offer unconditional love. And that's a confronting truth for many of us, that we may realize, oh my gosh, yeah, I need the other person to be perfect and absolute, like a superhero, because I'm not willing to offer unconditional love. I can only love and trust those who are perfect, or at least seem to be perfect in my own eyes, in my own projection. And it's okay, there is a part of the journey that is like that, but I personally feel another part of the journey has no problem with acknowledging, yeah, there may be some imperfection, a mild mistake, some relativity, some cultural influence that is playing out in this particular lifetime, but that's not affecting the inner world of divine love of that particular person. That will be my take, and that has cost me some friendships. Or relationships, because if there was true friendship, I don't think that will be the end of it after something like that. But yeah, some people think that that's offensive, that that's relativizing guru tattva or stuff like that. But for me, it's been realistic and acknowledging some obvious things that are there, that if you over-absolutize them, that creates its own set of troubles. Right?
Right. So,
So, for example, you refer to the guru being Sarvajna or Trikalajna. You have to understand what we mean by that. Guru is not omniscient like Krishna is. And even on Krishna's omniscience, I personally will say that he knows all possible things in the future, but not exact outcomes. Because if not, free will be meaningless in one sense. But that's another conversation. But in terms of a guru, I mean, you have the 64 qualities of Krishna. They are the first 50 jivas shared to some degree. The other 14 are not found in the jivas, tathasta jivas, are mostly found in Narayan and avatars. One of them is omniscience. So jivas are not omniscient. When we say that a guru is Trikalajna, which means knows the three stages of time, which means past, present, and future, that's not something to read literally, at least not in my opinion. It's something in the sense of a guru has the capacity of knowing, an enlightened being can know, can see you for who you are in the present. From that person, he or she, just in case, can relate the past momentum that brought you to this present moment. And by the way you are conducting in the here and now, they can have a clear idea where you are conducting yourself, But that doesn't mean that they exactly know what will be happening next weekend or something, because again, all this starts to make a mess with us having free will and stuff like that. So, and one last thing that you ask, okay, which are the qualities of Uttam Adhikari or Uttam Bhagavat, as described in the Bhagavatam? That Bhagavatam describes these three types of Adhikars in bhakti. So the Uttam Bhagavat is someone who is seeing Krishna everywhere and seeing everything Krishna and Krishna in everything, similar to what Krishna says in the sixth chapter of the Gita, Yumam Pashyati Sarvatra, Sarvam Cha Maya Pashyati. He or she sees me in everything and sees everything me. Now, what does it mean also? Because we are literalists in the West many times. Like, okay, it's that literally. That devotee is seeing Krishna emerging from every atom. No, don't play it that way. Because if you are seeing Krishna emerging at every step from every atom, you cannot function on society normally. It's you're overwhelmed. It's too much. No? But we see many of these great souls are functioning in society, so they are having a pers I mean, it's not that they are not having visions of Krishna, Spurti's darshan. But it's not that at every single moment Krishna is popping up at every single pore of creation in front of them. Because sometimes we tend to play all the things as overtly romanticized picture as we can. No, it means that they have this, yes, this perception of the divine everywhere, because yeah, God is omnipresent. So you can have a general sense of God's presence, a general realization of the divine presence, accompanying, protecting, nourishing, loving. That doesn't mean that you're hearing the flute 24/7 or Krishna is popping out of every atom, but you have this perception of seeing God everywhere, seeing the sacredness of everything. So again, that doesn't mean you are omniscient. That doesn't mean you may not have some mild mistakes. You may not have some cultural baggage that you may be carrying on some relative level. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Let's give one example. And again, it's a long conversation, and we can continue another day. But I don't know. Prabhupada famously said, gave it wrong size to woman's brain. Just to give you one example. Now, if you play the over-absolutizing button, you will say, okay, he's right. He cannot be wrong. Therefore, woman's brain must match that size. And if someone comes and says, no, that's not the actual size, then what? You have to make all women's brain on earth smaller to fit in with Prabhupada's statement or something, right? No, he was wrong. Does it make him less of a pure devotee? Not in my opinion. And the point for me, the most important point is that he was wrong and he was willing to be corrected and he changed his view when he was informed. Actually, that's not the case. He said, oh, okay. He changed his mind. That's the important thing for me here. That even shows more how much of a pure devotee he was. He was willing to be corrected and change his mind. Oh, great. Thank you. No, like another famous example that sometimes I quote, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was saying something, and he mispronounced a word. And many of his disciples at that time, again, going from this like more override idolatrous, I will say, spirit, with good heart, but idolatrous. They say, oh, Gurudev pronounced this word differently. So from now on, we have to change the dictionary. Right? Because they were not able to say Gurudev mispronounced the word. Actually, how he pronounced must be the proper way. And the dictionary is wrong. So we have to change the whole grammar of our language to fit in the new revelation that Gurudev just gave, that the word is actually pronounced in this way. And Srila Siddhar Maharaj was there and say, guys, you are taking it too far away. Relax. Now we just need to acknowledge that he mispronounced a word. That's it. Even that imperfection may create even more charm in the relationship. Oh, he mispronounced the word, charming. No? Oh, I'm being offered the chance of offering unconditional service. I can. can correct the word in my transcription of his lecture, so his mispronouncing is giving me an opportunity of service. I'm growing in unconditional service. In Krishna Lila, I did a series a few years ago on Kartik, like maybe almost 10 years ago, called Divine Imperfect, based on Damodar Lila, on how Krishna is in many ways so imperfect. Anyway, quote unquote imperfect, right? But he's lying, he's scared, he's been tied, he's been limited, and we haven't got yet to his Playboy Leelas, right? So he does many things that look that he's limited, that he, I mean, the infinite tie to a mortar, that looks ordinary. But that is facilitating intimacy between him and Yashoda. So the acknowledgement of all those apparently relative limiting elements is fostering proximity and affection. So that's happening, and that's how the Leela operates. So we should apply a similar template, I would say, when some of the things come from venerable figures. Going back to our first question on hierarchy, right? I can allow some of those mistakes. Again, as long as they're mild mistakes, we are not here to over justify grave abuses in the name of, it's a mild mistake and that allows to create more intimacy. No. So we need to discern there. So anyhow, a few thoughts, Jagannitha Prabhu. Again, we need our Austria retreat to delve further. That was a
Yes.
trailer. That was my promotion to it.
Okay.
And no clue when that Austria retreat will actually happen, but it's there. Now it's there in the collective mind. So
Yes. I
thank
would
you.
really appreciate it because so many new, how to say, ideas or thoughts are coming up into my mind to answer. Take responsibility for all of your statements, because if one goes really deep, then the word perfection gets a completely different meaning. So I don't want to take the time now, but I would really
I like,
appreciate to talk deeply about it.
thank you. No, I'm reminded what you, when you just say perfection takes a whole different meaning, and I'm reminded of Father Richard Rohr's definition of perfection, and he said perfection is the inclusion of imperfection, not the exclusion of imperfection. As simple as that. But many times we think perfection is the exclusion of
Yes,
imperfection. Everything has
that
to be
is.
perfect. There cannot be place for imperfection. No, perfection has to be so perfect that it even gives space for imperfection in a certain way that it becomes charming and increased love and increased intimacy. So it's not that we are here to do away with all imperfection, but just to deal with imperfection in a way that fosters proximity and closeness. And so, yeah, thank you. Thank you for all these reflections that you have created in us. Okay.
Thank you, Hare Krishna.
Let's keep this breakthrough room, as we sometimes keep some breakthrough room, because I remember there's one last list from the raised digital hands from Anurad or some. So you are invited to do it, and then we will go to one breakthrough room, and you then pick your topic, whether the one we just talked about and the one we'll be sharing in the next few minutes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I just wanted to say I don't feel that my question's fully formed in my mind as yet. And I noticed in the chat that Manjulali Manjari-dasi has a question. So I thought I'll think of it, but think on my own question first and ask it next week.
Okay, you're such a gentleman. Oh. Okay,
Thank
so
you.
then I have to go to the chat, right? Sorry, I don't follow much of the chat. It will be too much for me to deal with all the short circuiting in my own head and at the same time going through the simultaneous chat.
It says I can read you the question. Oh, I didn't want
I
to.
can find. Let me see.
Oh, you'll
Who?
find it.
Manjulali Manjari.
Manjulali Manjari Dasi. It's a
Yeah. Here it is.
okay.
Okay. Oh, I see. Okay, that was sent 40 minutes ago. Sorry not to be able to check it. So maybe somehow tied to some topics we already talked about. We'll see. So she says, you mentioned the notion of choice. Please, can you speak about how Krishna instructed Arjuna to fight and explain that the outcome will be the same? All the elders will die whether Arjuna will fight or not. How to understand choice, but at the same time, the outcome already being decided? Yeah, good question. Thank you. So we go back to our perennial conversation on free will and God's will, and how much God being omnipotent or controller, and how much that actually can take place without canceling our own will, and so on and so forth. So, well, the question begins saying that I mentioned that the notion of choice, and of course I did, but just in case, I'd like to clarify. Shastra mentions that. I'm just repeating that because it's clearly established in the scriptures that the soul has kart, the Atman has kartritva. No? Our kartritva means agency, more technically speaking, agency, that we have will. How free is our will? That's another question, depending on our past choices and samskaras acquired and all that. But yeah, we are a unit of will. So at the same time, we have this verse, right? Famous verse from the Bhagavad Gita. I think that's chapter 11, verse whatever, 33 or something, where Krishna is mentioning to Arjuna, yeah, they all will be dying. So no matter what you do, this is going to happen. So I will say a few things I can say, of course. The first thing is the intention of the verse in the context in which it appears is for Krishna is trying to encourage Arjuna to participate in the battle, knowing that Arjuna, as we say before, he wanted to run away. He didn't want to fulfill his duty, confront whatever he needed to confront. So Krishna is trying to encourage Arjuna to participate in the battle, but not from a place of false ego, ahankara, I will say, no, from excessive doership. Like implying it's not that it all depends on you, right? In one sense, there is already some momentum in this battlefield. What will happen, it's already clear that it will take place. No? It's like, I don't know if you. Just to give an example, it's like if you see two gangs in the street, right? Or two people, and they start to like to speak to one another more intensely and more intensely and more intensely, and the other one guy starts to insult, the other guy insults to the guy and starts to insult his mother as well. In one sense, you don't know, you're not having a crystal ball. We are not Trikalaknya, just say, we don't see the future. But you know what's going to happen in a few minutes. It's coming. I mean, you see it coming and it's coming and it's coming. So this is will be similarly. It's not that Krishna is absolutely seeing every single detail and therefore nobody's choosing anything and there's no free will and that's it. I won't explain it that way. It's just that there has been enough momentum created from both sides to have a clearer idea of what's going to take place, that on one side. So from that perspective, Krishna is telling Arjuna, trying to have Arjuna fighting for the right reasons, which at this level of the conversation is fight engaging in your dharma is virtuous unto itself. It doesn't matter what's the result. In fact, the result is already there. That's kind of the side note. By the way, the result is already there. It's clear what will happen. They will kill each other. But that doesn't mean that you are not to do your duty. Like inviting for this spirit of detached action. It's not so much, okay, I will only fight if I win, right? I will only participate in this situation if this happens. That's not the spirit to engage in our dharma, in our duty. So the main intention in this section is try to engage in dharma for dharma's sake. In other words, the fruit of dharma is the performance of dharma. To do your thing is the fruit itself. There's no separate fruit. That something may come, but that's secondary. No? And some things clearly are coming. Like in this case, something is clearly coming. That doesn't mean that you should stop doing your dharma or behaving in the way that you're expected to behave. Like, to give an example, I don't know. You're expected to behave in a certain way in your life. Something is clearly coming in your life, in a relationship, in a situation, I don't know, whatever. Your mom has a terminal cancer and she will pass next week. I'm giving such tragic example. Of course, your life will change in one sense, but in one sense, you are expected to be who you are. No? Something inevitable is coming, and that's inevitable in one way or another. So many things are inevitable, but that shouldn't totally affect who you are, so to say. Of course, you will adjust to any given situation, but at the end of the day, you have a call. You have a dharma, and dharma is not just limited to your social function in Varnashram Dharma. That's a level of understanding Dharma. But of course, then you have the deeper level of understanding Dharma, which is the deeper invitation of Krishna to Arjuna is fight because I love you and you love me, and I'm asking you to do so because that's necessary. I act as an offering of love. And of course, I know that it may be a little paradoxical for us to think, how can someone engage in a battlefield as an act of love to someone? But I mean, there's the extreme situation even points to, even in that case, that could be possible. So you can be loving in the worst possible scenario. That's the idea. So that's for me the main spirit here. It's not so much everything is decided in advance, nobody has any free will, because that will contradict the whole Siddhanta. If we have no free will, we are not Atma, because Atma has 21 intrinsic qualities mentioned by Jiva Goswami in Paramatma Sandarbha, and one is Kartritva, agency. If any of the intrinsic qualities of the Atma are taken out, which is not possible to begin with, we will stop existing. And one of the intrinsic qualities of the Atma is that it cannot stop existing. So each of those qualities have to be there, remain, preserve always. So we have to understand this section in ways that other truths spoken throughout the text, like Bhagavad Gita in the beginning, chapter 2, says, whatever something is, it can never stop being it, right? Whatever exists doesn't stop existing. So the Atma exists. The Atma cannot stop existing. Therefore, and the Atma exists as a unit of free will. That's intrinsic. So that cannot stop existing. That's chapter 2. Now we are here in chapter 11. But in chapter 11, you have to take in all the things that were said in the previous 10 chapters and see what is said in chapter 11 in the context of that. So that will be more the reading. Like, Krishna is clearly seeing this momentum, where this is taking. And he's trying to say it in a way to help Arjuna not to fight from a place of attachment to the result, of partiality. Okay, I will do this if my group wins, so to say, if my personal interest becomes favored. That's not the deal. No. Act for the love of God, so to say. Act for the love of what we are doing. And Arjuna is ready to embrace that level of invitation, as we will see, as we know. So that will be basically how we can read the verse, and at the same time keeping a coherent structure of what has been said so far before that verse. So I hope that helps, Manjulali Manjari. It was a very valid question. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so let's go one more time before we put our sharing to rest to the breakthrough rooms, and you are free to share whatever you feel inspired to share, whether it's more in connection of what I just explained or the topics connected to free will, gaps, omniscience, and role, and so forth, or what we talked before, which it's all connected regarding Prabhupada or how we relate to relativity in pure devotees. And feel free to choose. And of course, you will be with other people, so you may have different choices. So I look forward to the interesting combination of all that. So, invited to the groups now, and see you in a few minutes before we close the session today. Well, welcome back. Hoping you had a good nourishing tête-à-tête, one-on-one, on two or two or three with three in intimate sharing. And deep gratitude again for your presence today. Looking forward to our next meeting this coming next Saturday. But of course, for those of you who have time, also invited to our new series that we started last Monday. We are exploring the living heart of the Srimad Bhagavatam, a journey into its essential message. We are joining in this same Zoom link on Monday, same time, 2 p.m. EDT time. So more than invited. If not, we are sharing that in the YouTube channel. But if not, see you next Saturday for our next episode of the journey. Thank you all. Srimad Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bol.